Session number 28743.
Hugh Richardson, Reel 5. You just arrived in Gibraltar.
The settler arrived in Gibraltar, and we were all terribly disappointed that we didn't take a convoy to the UK. Instead of that, we were routed to Cape Town, Colombo, and Calcutta. As one would imagine, after a long trip already, we realized that we'd be several weeks, if not months, away from home again. But that was the way the war turned out. You went where you were sent. And we completed that part of the voyage, and then at long last we joined a convoy for the UK. We arrived in the Bay of Biscay in early December, and the storms in the bay are notorious for their tremendous impact on shipping, and they are in fact some of the worst storms that one can experience at sea in the whole world, in the Bay of Biscay at that time of the year. We came into the bay and we met a gigantic storm, a veritable tempest, waves of 50 feet high and a tremendous wind. And as she rolled and you went down into the cuff of the wind, of the wave, and when you came up again it was like coming up in a lift. And I was sure that the elements would sink the settler. Even though she was 16,000 tons, she was finding it hard through this tremendous sea. But fortunately, we did not sink. We came through it, and we were able to get into calmer waters. And strangely enough, we docked at the port of Milford Haven. And that was our desired haven, and that was the end of 13 months at sea.
Why had you been diverted round by Calcutta?
Yes, it was a strange affair. I don't really know why we went to Calcutta, because we picked up very little stuff, cargo, and those were our orders. And I remember we went up the Hooghly River to Calcutta, which is a notorious river. The pilots on this river are the highest paid pilots in the world, because the sandbanks and the various obstructions are so difficult to negotiate that the pilot has got to be highly skilled. And they took us up safely to Calcutta, but it's an extraordinary journey, because it's the river, I think I'm saying rightly saying, is about 100 miles long. It's a tremendous river, and it's full of difficulties for a ship, particularly a 16,000 ton ship. And we arrived in Calcutta safely enough, but I really don't know why we went there, because we were only there a few days and we turned back again. But these were the strange things that happened in the war. And I can remember we arrived at Colombo, and in Ceylon, as it was then, it's now Sri Lanka, of course. And I can well remember that they came aboard, and believe it or not, they installed a small anti-aircraft gun beside our 4-inch gun. And I can remember my friend, the Royal Navy gunner, being scathing about this gun. It had been captured in the desert of all places. It was an Italian breeder, and he said it was a toy. And he said that now that we've reached Colombo and Ceylon, he said we could have done with this toy in the Mediterranean, not out here. It's got no value whatsoever. He was completely scathing about it. But it was a strange, strange thing to do at that particular point of the voyage. And we left, of course, and came back to Cape Town, and then we joined a convoy for the UK. And that was our circuitous route to get back home and finish that voyage, which really, it carries so much incident that it was one of these voyages that you'd only have once in a lifetime.
Did you have any opportunity to experience the shore life in Ceylon or in India?
No, we didn't stay any length of time in Calcutta. Horrible place I found, Calcutta. Very noisy, very, very crowded. I can remember the sacred cows lying in the doorways of the shops, and the pavements covered with beetle juice, which is expectorated from the mouths of the inmates of the citizens. And that's about all I remember of Calcutta. It was not a nice place to be.
And after the settler, where were you posted to? What was the next ship?
The next ship, I think I'm right in saying, consult the certificate of continuous discharge. Now, this is a strange one. A ship called the Empire Raleigh. When I came back from the long voyage of the settler, I was appointed to as a radio officer on the Empire Raleigh. But strangely enough, the entry in the certificate of discharge does not show the ending of that voyage. I think, if my memory carries me back to that time, it was 1992. But I cannot remember what happened, because there is no entry at the finish of the voyage, so it must have been a very temporary posting. And then I went out to New York to pick up one of the Liberty ships, the Ocean Merchant. We stayed in New York for a fortnight in Times Square while they were completing this all-welded ship. Henry Kaiser, the big industrialist in America, was busy with his building program of all-welded ships up the creeks and rivers in America, bringing the parts down to the seaboard and putting them together and making a ship. And he was noted for his performance in making ships so quickly that he claimed that he actually built the same tonnage as was lost in the convoys. And that was a remarkable feat. He was also responsible for building the Sherman tank, which was so successful in the North African desert. So he had quite a claim to be one of the great producers of equipment during the war.
How did you get to America at that time?
We were sent out as passengers on another ship, and I'd imagine that it was the Empire Raleigh, because there's no ending to that voyage. If it had been a voyage, a complete voyage, there would be an entry when I joined and an entry when I came off. So that accounts for the blank in the certificate of discharge. Yes, it's the same. It's the same time of the dates. The dates are right. So that was it. And then when I came back from, we brought this Ocean Merchant ship into the UK and handed it over to the authorities. And then I did a rather foolish thing. Because of the length of the voyages that I had experienced and leaving my wife and family for so long, I volunteered to serve on a coaster, a small coaster which ran up this coast, the east coast, to from between Cardiff and Newcastle. So I joined this coaster, but unfortunately my experiences in the Mediterranean had left me in no fit state, really, to be back at sea. But there was no respite in those days. You had to serve, and you had to serve as quickly as you could, even after you'd been ill. And I had a form of mental exhaustion after the Mediterranean, and I went on this coaster, which was the worst thing I could possibly have done, because The coast, the east coast of England at that time was known as E-Boat Alley. The Nazis had built very fast motor launches, heavily armed, and they were attacking the coasters up this coast. And we loaded up Welsh coal in Bali, in Wales, and we were going up to Newcastle. And there is the truth of taking coals to Newcastle. And as we set off for this voyage, and it was an extraordinary little ship. My cabin contained a bunk, and I could just get in the door, and there was nothing else. There was just a bunk, and it was the most primitive ship you could possibly imagine. Obviously, they've got no space for anything. You were lucky if you had a chair to sit on. Anyway, we set off for this voyage, and it was a hair-raising voyage because we came out of Bari, and we sailed up the channel, and as we got nearing the Isle of Wight, the long-range guns in France started operating, and there was shelling across the channel, the shipping, and the south coast of England. Long-range stuff, very great guns. And we had to take shelter behind the Isle of Wight, which was an extraordinary affair. But there was nothing else we could do because they were shelling heavily when we passed through the channel. Well, we came to no harm with the shelling, and then we set off again for Newcastle. Well, the trip up the east coast with these very fast E-boats who arrived at a moment's notice, and the Royal Navy couldn't cope with them because their speed was so excessive. They were doing speeds of 50 to 60 knots, and the Navy had nothing that could chase even a thing at doing that speed. And of course they were deadly towards the shipping on this east coast of England. And we had several narrow escapes from these vessels. And I arrived in Newcastle, and I hate to admit it, but my nerve had gone. I couldn't stand any more of it, and they invalided me out of the ship and sent me home. And I came back home and had a period of leave.
When you were going back to your time in America before you picked up the Liberty ship, did you find that the attitude had changed?
Yes, I did. I did completely, completely. Pearl Harbor, of course, had long since taken place. The Americans were in the war, and no longer was a British uniform met with a degree of hostility. And I had a very good time. They put us in a hotel in Times Square while the ship was completing, and then we moved up to a little town in Maine, where she had completed her building, and we picked the ship up there. And I found nothing but very great friendliness in Portland, Maine. It was a small American town, and the Americans were absolutely grand. They invited us to their homes, and I experienced the experience of sitting in a rocking chair on the veranda with the American families, and it was absolutely first class. The difference between my previous visit and that visit was very marked. But of course there were no allies in the war, and very much so, and they had changed their attitude towards a British uniform. That was a very pleasant interlude. I experienced a small American town, which is so different from New York and Philadelphia and Boston. I didn't like New York. I hated New York because it was so frenetic. The pace of New York is something to be experienced, not for me. It was too frenetic for me. But Portland, Maine was ideal, a small American town.
How did sailing the Liberty ship differ from your previous two ships?
It was it was purely a functional ship with compartments or holds, to be more exact. The accommodation was very sparse, very, very functional, but very uncomfortable. It was what it purported to be, a cargo carrier. It wasn't a ship in our sense of the word. It had no atmosphere at all. In contrast with the previous ships I served in, there was no atmosphere on a Liberty ship. You had to accept the bare minimum in accommodation. Food was, of course, excellent, and no trouble with that, but the accommodation was really, really, really functional. I can't remember whether she was not terribly fast. I suppose she did about 10 or 12 knots, but the speed was not there, really. But she sailed well enough. There was no trouble from that, but the trouble was the apprehension which one felt that she was welded together, and if anything had struck her, the sinking of her would have taken a very short time indeed, because the welding would never have withstood a torpedo or a bomb. A British-built ship, built on the Clyde, if I may be insular for once, would have at least stood up to the treatment it received in the war, but not a Liberty ship. They were purely functional.
And the coaster you were in, could you describe a bit about that?
The coaster?
The ship itself.
The ship itself. Well, it was primitive, if I may use that word. It was completely, again, functional. The Kari Cole and the crew were not considered at all. I've instanced the question of the cabin I slept in. There was a bunk and nothing else, and it wasn't comfortable, and it was so small that any sea had the maximum effect. I disliked the experience of a coastal very much, because you can still meet some seas up the east coast of England. You might not be in the Bay of Biscay, but I should shudder to think what would have happened to it in the Bay of Biscay. It was purely built for a coal carrier, and that was its function. No, it was not comfortable.
And you had a period of leave?
Yes, I had a period of leave because I had a breakdown, and it was compulsory leave. And then, of course, I had a very good experience of being seconded to the Ministry of War Transport, and I was sent out to Naples to join Director of Harbour Craft Staff in Naples. So that was the end of the convoys as far as I was concerned. I went out as a passenger on a passenger ship, and I had an interesting experience on that ship. I met a man who was a secret agent, and he was going out to Italy to be flown into Yugoslavia, and he was going to contact, on behalf of the British government — he shouldn't have told me the things he did tell me — he was going to contact the partisan leader, who was not Marshal Tito. He was the opponent of Tito, and this British agent was going to contact this partisan leader in Yugoslavia. He was going to be dropped by parachute into the country, and his job was to contact this man and try and build up a partisan force in Yugoslavia, which would have been in opposition to Marshal Tito. He finished off Marshal Tito, but he was just called Tito then. He was the other partisan leader, and like sometimes happens, we backed the wrong horse. We backed the wrong partisan leader. The British government were at fault there. They didn't think that Tito was going to become the dictator of Yugoslavia, as he did do. And he was a marvelous man in many ways. He was a wonderful partisan leader, and of course became a first-class dictator. He did a lot for Yugoslavia. He kept it together, and now it's fragmented into different states. Tito was the savior of a dictator was the savior of Yugoslavia at that time, which was it was interesting meeting this agent. I suppose he told me the things he did tell me because he thought, well, I wasn't going anywhere and I was a government official anyway. But it was an interesting experience. What happened to the other partisan leader, I don't know. He fell by the wayside and Tito took over the country.
How did you come to the position that you were seconded to?
Exactly, that's a very good question. I had no knowledge of shipping. I had a knowledge of sailing in ships, but I had no background knowledge of a shipping line. My colleague in Naples owned a shipping company in America and was completely conversant with all the ways of running ships. I had very limited knowledge of shipping, and it was an extraordinary appointment, really, because as I had to go as an observer at the Mediterranean Shipping Board, and I was in some doubt as to whether I was capable of being there, because I had to know the facts about the director of Harbourcraft's craft and in the various ports. And if I had been asked a question by the chairman, I had to answer it. And it was a very great responsibility, because with my limited knowledge of shipping from the port side, I was fighting against that lack of knowledge, and I was completely aware of it, as one would be in a very high class assembly of all the fighting chiefs, air marshals, and downwards and upwards, and Americans as well, the Royal Navy. There was a huge gathering in that room of about at least 50 people. And I was very much a minnow in a large pool. And when I look back on it, I even get terrified now, because it could have been a very difficult experience. But fortunately, that didn't happen. I was able to carry it off. But it was quite remarkable that I should be given an appointment in such an organization. When I look back on it, it was extraordinary. I mean, because my colleague, as I say, owned a shipping line in America, so he knew all about shipping. And when I served with NWTR, Harvey Black, he was a Black and Donaldson shipping line in Glasgow. There were people who were connected with the actual running of a shipping line, and I had only served as a very minor officer on board ships, and it was extraordinary that I managed to find myself in Naples with an office in Navy House, Naples, and so on, and I was there for a year, so I must have carried out the function with some degree of success.
When was it you arrived in Naples? What was that? Was it 1944?
The end of 1944, I arrived in Naples, Christmas Eve, strangely enough, and there was snow on Vesuvius. I couldn't believe it. I thought, this is sunny Italy. There shouldn't be snow on Vesuvius, but there was. And the first night, we couldn't get into the arrangements had not been made properly, and we couldn't get into a block of flats that the ministry was running in Naples. So we had to spend the night in a beautiful house that had marble floors, and it was cold beyond description. My first taste of southern Italy was quite remarkable. I thought, this is the land of sunshine, not snow on Vesuvius. But it was, and I suffered a very cold night, I can assure you. But we moved into the flats, the apartments in the block that they had in Naples. And then I decided that Naples was far too noisy, and a colleague of mine and I decided that there were constant riots in the streets below, and the Italians were a very volatile people, and they used to attack the British sailors. The war was up north then, and they had really they had given up the war to a large extent, but they didn't stop them from attacking a British uniform. And my colleague and I said to ourselves, well, we'll look for a flat outside the ministry building. And we found a small flat on what is called the Vomero. The Vomero is the high part of Naples. It's reached by the funiculari, which is a form of railway which one chain pulls the car up and the other one comes down. We got to this flat in the Vomero with the most magnificent balcony overlooking the Bay of Naples. It was the finest view in the world stretched before us. And I used to call my colleague a Philistine because he used to sit on the balcony in the morning shaving himself and not looking at the view at all. And I say to him, "You're a Philistine. Imagine shaving yourself and you're looking at the most magnificent view in all the world." "Oh, I'm getting busy shaving myself." Yes, so much for my colleague. But it was very... We spent several months there. In fact, he was sent home, not because he didn't look at the view, but he was sent home on another job. He had gone into Schaeff, I think it was, Eisenhower's headquarters, and as did Harvey Black. He became quite big in Allied headquarters, Schaeff. And I was left there to have this flat on my own, but I didn't mind that. It was quite fabulous view from that balcony. Wonderful. The whole Bay of Naples stretched below you, and Vesuvius in the background. On a moonlight night, it was out of this world. And I did not shave on the balcony. That was my period in Naples and Rome, of course. I went to Rome. And I had another wonderful experience. I had a brother-in-law who was a pilot, and he had done so many trips in the Lancasters that he was sent to be to run the Western Leaf Centre in Sorrento, of all places, which is one of the places one wishes to go. And right across the bay from me, of course, in Naples, and of course I used to go down there weekends, and Sorrento is quite something. I can well understand the song that... Return to Sorrento. I would certainly go back there any day. It's a beautiful little place. And of course I had the experience of transporting the late Gracie Fields from her villa in Capri, which is called the Song of the Sea, Canzone del Mare. And I picked Gracie Fields up in a tug. The bay was choppy that night, and I couldn't take a launch, so I took one of our small tugs out to Capri and picked Gracie up from her villa. And I said to her, "Gracie, you're going to travel in an unusual way for you tonight." She said, "How is that, Hugh?" And I said, "Well, I've brought a tug." "A tug?" "Yes, because I couldn't bring a launch. It's too choppy." "Oh, I don't mind that. I should come in the tug." And I took Gracie over to Naples, to the opera house, where she sang for the troops. And she was a tremendous success, as one could imagine. And she repeated the appearance in the opera house 3 times. And I remember the song that she sang, which went down very well, "Wish Me Luck As You Wave Me Goodbye." And the famous trill in her voice was operated. She had a wonderful high voice and a thoroughly charming lady. And I thoroughly enjoyed escorting her to Navy House from Capri to the Opera House.